Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Welcome back to our audio course, Mindfulness Where Dharma Meets Practice. This is the fourth of 10 talks and the second and concluding talk on living in virtue. Last week, we talked about giving and how precepts help us become harmless. Purity. The mind is the basis of all of our practice. All of our intentional actions begin in the mind. Whether we adhere to precepts or choose to earn merit, they come from the mind, and they then reshape our karmic landscape. Recall that I talked about driving an ox cart in our second talk as a metaphor for learning and unlearning habit patterns. In the end, we want to develop the kind of mind that cannot be other than virtuous. This is purity. To develop purity, we take up the introspective practice of mindful observation of what goes on in the mind. The full implementation of this task relies on bringing to mind a wide swath of psychologically oriented teachings. These will further expand as we develop wisdom alongside virtue. Precepts and giving produce purity. Once we enter into the practices of precepts and giving, we already step into the practice of purifying the mind. This is because we're forced to confront contrary impulses wherever they tend toward harm or away from benefit. Every time effort struggles to keep up with mindfulness of a precept, every time we override a contrary mental factor, we jump out of a rut and begin to decondition an existing unskillful habit pattern. Every time kindness or generosity inspires our good deeds, we shape our karmic landscape into a more skillful topology. Even mixed motives have a way of eventually giving way to purer motives. Examples are responses to peer or authority pressure or obligations without kindness. When our actions start to bring delight, pure motives are settling in. For instance, recall the precept not to assault living beings. Maybe we do not initially understand why the life of an ugly twiddle bug matters one snippet. But a twiddle bug is a living being, and we want to be good Buddhists so we don't kill twiddle bugs. After a few months, we'll discover something that was not there before, a warm heart with regard to twiddle bugs. They will have become our little friends. And we will find that this result generalizes to other ugly beings as well, and even to certain people that we had once put into the same category with twiddle bugs. Our mind has become purer. We have seen earlier that a number of precepts actually have little directly to do with refraining from evil. But they produce the kind of mind that will want to avoid evil, or they strengthen factors like mindfulness that contribute to the result. Breaking a precept against idle chatter, for instance, is relatively victimless. However, if we refrain from idle chatter over many months, we will discover a quieter mind, less prone to distraction. And what do distractions disrupt? Mindfulness. We will have, simply through observing this precept, made the mind purer. Such precepts develop purity of mind in much the same way as precepts that avoid immediate harm. That's why we practice them as well. You should try to refrain from depurifying the mind. Just as new habit patterns may, over time, purify the mind, our lives may already involve habit patterns that inadvertently depurify the mind. These deepen unskillful ruts in our karmic landscape. We do well to refrain from these. A rather complex precept, for instance, is commonly observed by laypeople every quarter moon and by monastics almost always. To refrain from dancing, singing music, going to see entertainments, wearing garlands, smartening with perfumes, and beautifying with cosmetics. This list is of activities that are actually quite normal. They are maybe of concern for only the most dedicated practitioners. Still, they tend to be motivated by and reinforce unskillful lust and pride. Even more so, the modern pursuits of playing violent video games and watching violent television programs or listening to hateful speech on the radio will turn the mind toward recurring thoughts of anger and fear. Entertainments that excite lust will tend also to depurify the mind, even while doing no immediate harm. We turn on the TV, and pretty soon it has us dancing to a tune of lust, envy, fear, hatred, anger, fantasy, and buying. It provokes our entire repertoire of unwholesome mental urges that our practice otherwise tries to moderate. We do well to dehabituate such activities. To understand what is unskillful in our minds, we have to understand greed, aversion, and delusion. What follows are some of the Dharma teachings to bear in mind as we mindfully observe our intentions. The Buddha divides the innumerable kinds of unskillful, unwholesome intentions into three broad categories. There are these three roots of what is unskillful. Which three? Greed as a root of what is unskillful. Aversion as a root of what is unskillful. Delusion as a root of what is unskillful. These are the three roots of what is unskillful. The roots of the skillful are the opposites of the unskillful: non-greed, non-aversion, and non-delusion, also known as renunciation, kindness, and wisdom. Greed is neediness, the desire, longing, attachment, or lust for sensual pleasures, for reputation or fame, for wealth, for power, for comfort, for security, and so on. Greed includes simple lust for food or sexual gratification, pride, the need to be liked, popular, or famous, or to be secure, rich, or beautiful. Greed generally looks outward for satisfaction or personal advantage. Aversion, also known as hatred, is the dislike, dread, or fear of pain, of discomfort, of enemies, and so on. Aversion includes thoughts of anger, revenge, envy or jealousy, resentment, guilt, self-hate, disdain, negative judgments, and quickly manifests as anxiety and restlessness. Both greed and aversion are tied to the craving highlighted in the Second Noble Truth we talked about in Living in Mindfulness. Greed pulls nearer, aversion pushes away. Both want something. Delusion is found in erroneous views or justifications, conceptualizations, misperceptions, ignorance, and denial. Delusions are hardest to see. That's why we call them delusions. The greatest delusion for the early Buddhist is that there is an abiding self, a me, that in some way remains fixed in spite of all of the changes that happen all around it, that is also the owner and controller of this body and this mind, a self that is fearful of, but is always looking for, personal advantage in the world out there. Greed and aversion have their basis in the sense of self, which tends to take things personally in a self-centered way. Delusion is a major target of the practice of wisdom, which we will look at when we talk about living in wisdom. The Buddha observed that unskillful intentions have five qualities in common, absent in skillful intentions. One, they have unskillful roots, either in greed, in aversion, or in delusion. Two, when unskillful intentions give rise to bodily or verbal actions, these actions generally cause harm to self or others. Three, unskillful intentions give rise to misperception. Four, unskillful intentions cause personal suffering. Five, unskillful intentions are an obstruction on the path to awakening. Let's take anger as an example. Anger is a particularly volatile form of aversion, unskillful roots, that arises quickly and generally disperses just as quickly. It easily leads to verbal or physical assault, otherwise protected by the first precept or by the precepts around malicious or harsh speech, harm. Through angry eyes, the object of our anger, even a close friend or family member, easily manifests as a jerk or a schmuck, if not as a demon, misperception. But when the anger subsides, it will morph back into its normal, more amiable form. The level of tension associated with the arising of even slight anger is astonishing, and great anger plunges us into a hell-like state right here and now. Suffering. We are all aware that habitual or sustained anger can even affect our physical health, high blood pressure, heart disease, etc., in a profound way. Moreover, should anger become more ingrained through habituation, it'll become increasingly difficult to bring the mind into states of calm and insight necessary for liberation, obstruction. Now, mindful observation or investigation is the greatest engine of mental development. With every action we undertake, we consistently attend to the intention. To begin with, we're mindful to discern whether it is skillful or unskillful. We can trace these intentions as they arise in making ethical choices or as they contribute to our personal suffering. They affect both. Unwholesome intentions are those wearing some degree of suffering, stress, anxiety, dis-ease, or dissatisfaction, like a shadow. They will also fall under at least one of the categories of greed, aversion, and delusion, and when acted out will almost certainly cause someone harm. We might be embarrassed at how much unwholesomeness we discover as various factors make an appearance in turn. Anger, lust, deluded views, fear, stress, envy, jealousy, spite, restlessness, anxiety, arrogance, judgment, and pride. We will discover how common these factors are when we tune in to the stress and anxiety that are right there, even when we thought we were having fun. It's important to accept this stream as a natural part of the untrained human condition. Otherwise, you might feel guilty, and guilt is just another unskillful thought, one rooted in aversion. Nonetheless, mindful observation provides immediate, though temporary, relief from the effects of unskillful factors. For instance, when mindfulness attends to the anger itself, which is different from the content of the anger, our energy goes into the observation of the anger. This leaves little energy for direct engagement with the anger itself. As a result, the anger tends to dissipate. Our meditation practice helps us discover this. This technique should be part of every Buddhist's right effort toolbox. Moreover, repeated mindful observation confronts our delusions about the role of the impure mind in causing suffering, and thereby suffices to undercut the most stubborn, unskillful habit patterns. Miraculously, the unskillful roots begin slowly to loosen their grip when we see them clearly. With persistence and time, the mind shifts remarkably. In this way, purity of mind develops. Mindful observation also reveals the conditions that give rise to what is unskillful. For instance, if we see that stress gives rise to anger, then we begin to avoid stressful activities. This is much as the recovering alcoholic sees that if he doesn't avoid the company of people who drink, then he will experience the impulse to do so himself. We can similarly avoid circumstances that tend to lead us into undesirable but accustomed ruts. Turning from mindfulness to effort, it should be possible to practice restraint. For instance, we stop before an unwholesome thought turns to speech. Particularly challenging is restraint when faced with angry thoughts, which can overwhelm our discernment very quickly. But even these will come under the control of right effort as we reach advanced stages of practice. There are a variety of techniques for restraint at this critical junction between thought and bodily or verbal action, and we'll discover some of our own. For instance, we learn never ever to write an email in an angry frame of mind. If some anger trigger needs to be addressed, we wait until the mind is calm, then address it with gentle words at the right time. We find that we avoid a lot of regret in this way. Face-to-face encounters that turn to anger might require that we quietly and abruptly leave the room to go simmer down. Otherwise, we might utter something demeritorious. Recall that mindfulness discerns when dharmic parameters are about to be breached, and effort does something about it. Gradually, we learn to improve the quality of our intentions, to weed out the unwholesome, and to cultivate the wholesome. Meanwhile, mindful observation improves right understanding. This, in turn, refines the parameters we bear in mind. Virtue is its own reward. In earlier talks, we discussed the win-win claim about the fruition of karmic results in our lives, how we are heirs to our own deeds, how we benefit ourselves while benefiting others. Often people imagine this must mean some kind of cosmic payback system, much like Santa's naughty and nice list. Actually, we're now in a position to understand the psychology that suffices to establish this claim. First, let's ask, what kind of personal harm is there in the unwholesome? A bit earlier, we discussed the five qualities of unskillful intentions. Two of them are worth repeating here. They cause personal suffering, and they are an obstruction on the path to awakening. Whereas obstruction speaks of long-term effects, suffering is felt, at least in part, immediately. Intentions rooted in greed, aversion, and delusion are simply stressful or even painful, as we described earlier, particularly with regard to anger. Also, as we continue to behave in unskillful ways, these same intentions are likely to recur over and over again. This means that they score deeper and deeper ruts in our karmic landscape and start to determine more and more our character, future behavior, and future well-being. Each time we fall into these ruts, we experience the suffering of the unwholesome all over again. At one point, we were a person who happened to experience anger. Now we are an angry person. In this sense, we are heir to our own deeds. We even begin to experience the health problems of an angry person. Next, let's ask, what kind of benefit is there in the wholesome? Buddhist practice across the board finds its natural home in inhabiting our activities for their own sake. This is different from the dominant instrumental or utilitarian orientation of most people. This is more like children who play for no other reason than because they love to play, or like those who watch birds or solve puzzles simply out of delight in doing so, or those who wash dishes in order to wash dishes and not in order to have clean dishes. We saw in earlier talks how the general practice of mindfulness by itself nudges the motivational structure of our activities in this direction. Mindfulness encourages us to inhabit our tasks by focusing on the how aspect rather than to utilize them by striving toward the why. We now understand why striving is unskillful. In these last talks, we've gained a far better understanding of skillfulness from the perspective of virtue and how striving, based in greed and/or aversion, leads to immediate suffering, anxiety, stress, and so on, and to other problems. Also, it is a self-concerned distraction from the task at hand and disrupts recollection of what is relevant to the task in itself. The practice and understanding of virtue add depth to this motivational structure achieved in mindfulness. The nudge gives general mindfulness a somewhat upright quality, but the mindful practice of virtue provides a broader context for practice. This points to the critical difference between mindfulness and right mindfulness. A sniper or a jewel thief can engage his skill mindfully by holding striving momentarily at bay. But at the same time, he is engaged in a plan fraught with wickedness, conceived in past karma without regard to the standards of virtue. Right mindfulness, on the other hand, recollects the entire Dharma as needed, and so will never neglect the standards of virtue. To the extent we can lay striving aside, we learn to inhabit our acts of virtue, we find satisfaction and delight in living according to the standards of harmlessness, giving, and kindness. This is why this talk is called Living in Virtue. As we live in virtue, we lose me in concern for the well-being of all, and we enjoy a far greater sense of personal well-being. This underscores once more that we are heirs to our own deeds and that virtue is its own reward. Pursuing tasks of all kinds in this way, that is, for their own sake, is found also in psychological research to lead to a far greater sense of well-being. We saw earlier also that the skill of general mindfulness naturally produces stability of mind. The mind settles on a single theme, does not thrash from one thing to another, acquires a certain delight in the present, and steps back from our direct engagement in affairs. The pure mind is further calmed through the larger context of non-regret, particularly in association with whatever plans might stand behind our current tasks. The Buddha speaks of a natural progression that arises effortlessly in the virtuous person. This points to another dimension of living in virtue. Monks, for a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no volition need be exerted. Let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in one who is virtuous. One whose behavior is virtuous. For one without regret, and so on, it is natural that joy arises in one without regret, and so on. It is natural that delight arises in one who is joyful. It is natural that the body of one with a delighted mind is tranquil. It is natural that one who is tranquil in body feels pleasure. It is natural that the mind of one feeling pleasure is composed. Variations of the progression, delight gives rise to tranquility, and tranquility gives rise to mental composure, are found in the context of a lot of Buddhist practices. Here, this progression is said to be a natural, effortless consequence of the practice of virtue. This touches on the supramundane aspect of practice, whose experience far exceeds normal mundane fun. How about an example? Once In the groove of mindful ethical conduct, the new practitioner can begin to observe this dimension at least beginning to play out. For example, one day you're doing laundry. You find your housemate has left a lot of clothes in the dryer. At first you think, I've got places to go and things to do. I'll just pull everything out and dump it on the table. But then you are mindful to see this as a prime opportunity for merit-making. You remember that this is a fundamental aspect of devout Buddhist practice. You decide, oh boy, I'll neatly fold my housemate's clothes. Accordingly, you engage the task of folding clothes mindfully. You put aside whatever thoughts are not relevant to folding clothes. You bear appropriate standards in mind. For instance, you take care to fold precisely and symmetrically along seams. At one point, an errant twiddle bug pokes his head out from a pocket. You recall the first precept, catch him with a pair of tongs from the kitchen, and place him carefully outside. There you go, little guy. Then you proceed with the task at hand, practicing for the sake of practice itself with no striving and no hurry. The mind feels upright, steady, exalted and pure, and proceeds from non-regret to joy, to delight, and so on. If you've done such a practice many times, this might carry you as far as right mental composure. While any sense of striving for self-advantages recedes for the duration of this episode, you realize that this is the proper and joyful way to live your life, that is, in virtue.
Further resources related to this course, Mindfulness, Where Dharma Meets Practice, are available at Sitagu, that is SITAGU, sitagu.org/shortlinks/mindful.